Okay. I had a follow-up thought from a question that was asked last week. And the question was something like how to allow... We were talking about how we allow the scriptures to wash over us, or reading Dogen to wash over us. And the person asked, how do you allow that to happen with other people? And he expressed some difficulty kind of trying to figure out what other people were communicating to him. And at the time, I could have also added, and want to add now, that there is actually a difference between how we listen to a Dharma talk, listen to a scripture, read something like Dogen, and how we listen to and hear other things in our lives, other things in the world. And it has, you can kind of think of it as sort of degrees of openness. When we listen to something like Dogen, or read Dogen, or read the morning service scriptures, for instance, and we're trying to listen to that from the point of view of meditation, we're trying to listen from a perspective of allowing it all to just come in and do whatever it's going to do. There's the ideal is there's a quality of kind of complete trust in allowing that information to come in. And it's different than how we watch television, for instance, where there's a kind of level of alertness that we could cultivate when we're watching television. That some of the stuff, you kind of have your critical intelligence engaged in a certain way. When you're watching television, you might think, oh, well, I don't really need to believe in that, if you know what I mean, whatever it is from your perspective. And equally is true with other people. There's a kind of way of listening to other people, being still in meditation, where we're not really necessarily letting it all in as if it were the gospel.
It's basically like having filters on.
Yeah.
And we try to not have those filters on when we're meditating. We just all...
Yeah, right. We try to allow our filters to drop away, when we're listening to the morning service scriptures, allow them to drop away when we're reading someone like Dogen. Yes?
Is that because there's a kind of protocol of communication that we have with people, and that if you just kind of... You know, does that make sense?
It does make sense, and that's part of it. Although the more important part of it is that, realistically speaking, there are things happening in the world that we don't necessarily want to buy into. Okay, and someone may be talking to us from a perspective that isn't necessarily enlightened. Okay, I mean, people have ill intent, people have misunderstood ideas about situations, misunderstood ideas about the relationship, and we just want to be somewhat careful about that. We can cultivate a childlike attitude toward people, a non-judgmental attitude toward people, but we don't necessarily have to follow along with what their view is. And it's important, particularly when things are emotionally charged, or you know, there's a potential for misunderstanding with other people. It's not that I'm telling you that you should be judgmental. It's just that, as Natalie kind of points out, you can have a kind of filter on what's really happening here. What are the different elements of this conversation? And from the point of view of meditation, you can often hear that. You know, you can hear, there was a person that I worked with for a long time who, it was my perception, I can't prove it, who was kind of a little squiffy with what the truth was. And she would, I felt, try to manipulate me. I was the boss and she was the person working, and it was a very interesting a learning experience for me to listen to her with an open mind and not react from the defensiveness that you can have when someone is trying to manipulate you or mess with you, and still not be manipulated or messed with. And it was so it was a kind of exercise in meditation and action, listening. What is she saying? What are the needs that she's expressing? What is good to do here for the whole group? And going forward on that basis, if you see what I'm getting at. So does that make sense? Does that example make sense? So in other words, there are just levels of care that we take with information that we take in. And from the point of view of our practice, of our religious or spiritual lives, we can approach the scriptures with a much greater openness of mind and allow them to come in and do what they're going to do. That said, if something comes in and it raises a question about something for you, then we should definitely look into that question. So, for instance, in some translations of the Sharangama Sutra, which is a really long sutra fundamental to Mahayana Buddhism, they make some remarks that are disparaging to women. And these are not supported by the Buddha Dharma. This disparagement of women is not supported by the Buddha Dharma. And so I've known people, women, who read that and said, well, what's this? These remarks are disparaging to women. And so we should explore that and look into it and say, you know, what is really going on here? And not necessarily take that at face value. Does that make sense? And any time you encounter something that you're listening to and it does something, you know, like, oh, what's that? We should explore that. We should find out about that. We should talk about it with others. We should see what's going on. We should, you know, kind of at some point in the future, sit down and think about that and what that means. Study it. Find out what's going on. The Buddha Dharma, what the Buddha taught is how to end suffering. And so I'm sure what the Buddha is trying to teach us does not increase our suffering, if that makes sense. So something in the Dharma or something in the presentation is at least even temporarily increasing our suffering, we should look at that and see what's going on. Okay. Okay. Hopefully that's clearer than mud. Now, I realize this chapter that we're talking about, Genjo Koan, is quite dense. There's a lot of stuff in here. And I was just thinking earlier, I was reading it, and, you know, within the first year of my practice as a layperson, one of the first priests that I was ever kind of, you know, kind of was a teacher for me, was explaining this, and I was remembering his explanation of it. So I've been kind of thinking about it and exploring it for a long time. So there's a lot of different stuff in here, and we'll probably just kind of scratch the surface in the three talks that I'm giving, but at least it will give us an introduction. So the next line, when we wish to teach and enlighten all things by ourselves, we are deluded. When all things teach and enlighten us, we are enlightened. To enlighten delusion is to become Buddha. This is pretty straightforward, and it goes to, and it kind of explains and gives a foundation for the way that a temple is structured in terms of teaching and what's going on in terms of our practice. When you, particularly when you become a novice monk, you're asked to not try to teach anybody at all. You're just asked to just put that down for the time and really just focus on your own training and practice. And this is sort of the foundation of everything that we practice and do. There's a great example of this in Reverend Master Jiyu's own life, where she wrote this book, How to Grow Lotus Blossom. And this is the kind of description of her retreat and experience of a deepening in her practice. And one of the first things that she did at this point in her training, when this began to happen, was that she released her disciples from discipleship, and she stepped down from being abbot of Shasta Abbey at the time. She, in effect, returned to simply being a novice. In effect, returned to simply looking at her own training and practice. And I think this is a really important example that she gave to us, that the foundation of even the greatest of teachers is this willingness to be taught by circumstances, this willingness to look at her own training, to look deeply into her own way of doing things, and being willing to change that way of doing things. So it's a really important thing. I was thinking, in our tradition and in many traditions where there are monks, it's usually the case that the monks are the teachers and the lay people are whatever, they're the trainees, although that's a kind of artificial division. Well, and that's the way that the Buddha Dharma has been passed on for generations and generations, and it is what it is. But to look more closely is actually to see that everybody within the Buddha Dharma is this trainee. Everybody is in the position of just continually coming back to working on their own training. For some people, it's their training to explain the Dharma, and actually, over the years, it has become the training of some lay people to explain the Dharma to others. But even if that is the case, there's never a point where you can say, I'm so enlightened that I don't need to train myself anymore. If you ever encounter someone like that, if I ever give any indication of that, please, kind of say, oh, Reverend Leon, you're doing it. have suspicion about that kind of attitude. Okay. Because it gives expression to a certainty that may not be actual. It may not be a real certainty. And as we go on, this is a theme in this particular chapter, that idea of certainty. And it, in fact, is continuing on with an idea that we talked about last week, about going beyond. Since the way of the Buddha transcends unity and duality, all of the above exist. In other words, we go beyond the point where we have the certainty of unity and just return to our training from the perspective of non-duality. And it is true that within the Buddha Dharma there are different stages. There are people who have more experience than other people. I certainly know that there are monks and teachers in the order and in the world and in history that know a lot more, have a lot deeper experience of practice than I do. And so I cultivate in myself the willingness to go to those people for help, for refuge. And that's a kind of fundamental part of our practice. Okay, so when we wish to teach and enlighten all things by ourselves, we are deluded. In other words, when we think we're so great that we can teach others, it's usually a mistake. Maybe for some it's not, but most of the time it's a mistake. And part of the mistake is actually a profound issue. Part of the mistake is what Master was pointing at this morning in his dedication about our own view of ourselves. When we have any particular opinion about ourselves, it creates a self. It says, here's a self that is separate from the rest of the world. And that is deluded. Okay? When all things teach and enlighten us, we are enlightened. In other words, when we don't have that separation, when we don't have that sense of I'm me and you're you, I'm good, you're bad, I'm enlightened, you're unenlightened, when we don't have that dualistic sense, then everything can teach us according to what it has to teach. The compost busily sits in composts in the compost pile. It teaches us by its smell and view and all that stuff. We don't really want to eat that, okay? The refrigerator is filled with food that teaches us what it has to say. You know, oh, this is food that's ready to eat. This is food that's ready to be washed. All this, these things are constantly communicating to us, and they communicate to us. They're in a sense, proper use and place in the world. They're enlightening us. Because there isn't a dualistic separation between us and them. There's no kind of sense of I'm better than or anything like that. This is a really different way of looking at the world. The Buddha Dharma, and I think I kind of constantly have to remind myself of this. The Buddha Dharma is a really different way of looking at the world than we encounter in the Judeo-Christian sort of Abrahamic view of life. Okay, it's different in the sense that it's internally focused, and the internal focus of it is expressed in a great line, which we haven't gotten to yet, but is right here in this chapter. When one studies Buddhism, one studies oneself. When one studies oneself, one forgets oneself. When one forgets oneself, one is enlightened by everything. And this very enlightenment breaks the bonds of clinging to both body and mind, not only for oneself, but for all beings as well. So we're looking within, we're studying ourselves, and we're studying ourselves to let go of the self. That's the forgetting oneself. And when one forgets this separation, then there's a different kind of experience that arises from that. It doesn't actually change anything. It doesn't change the condition of the world. There was a journal article that Reverend Master Kokhead wrote about a person who lived in Germany in the 30s, and he was effectively a male prostitute. And in a situation where he was sort of forced to be a male prostitute. And it talked about this man who was remembered by a priest as being almost saintly in his loving kindness. That this person was able to, within these very extreme circumstances, which we would not wish to upon anyone, to actually just love the beings that he was being of service to. And it is important for us to understand again that that is how the Dharma is different. We're looking at the world not in the sense of trying to change it into something else, but in the sense of trying to change our own minds so that we may perceive the world in a different way. And that different way is to accept, to love, whatever word you want to put on it, in a way that, in a sense, transcends the trouble of the world, goes beyond the trouble of the world. To enlighten delusion is to become Buddha. That is what I'm talking about there. To enlighten delusion is to train ourselves to let go of that judgmental mind, to train ourselves to let go of the sense of self and other. I'm a good self, and therefore I'm okay. You know, we're so complicated internally. I look at myself and I think, on one level, there's part of me that thinks I'm really lousy. I'm a really kind of shameful person. I don't really like to look at that part of myself. That's kind of down there, and I don't really want to go there because I kind of believe that it's true. And then there's the part of me that's responding to that, which is making myself all competent and trying to make everybody like me and all that stuff. And I can kind of live there because the things that I'm doing are acceptable. You know, they're good, they're beneficial for the world, or all this kind of thing. But still there's this level of dissatisfaction, like it's not quite working. And then there are all, you know, different other kind of responses to that. And part of our practice is being willing to sit in that place where we feel kind of really, many unpleasant words kind of come to mind. Maybe I should just say ashamed of ourselves for whatever reason, for whatever suffering is there. And to see within that, that it is not true. That it is not true. That we are as we think we are. Whatever happened may well have happened, but on that deep, in a deep way, we are not as bad as we think we are. We are not bad in the way that we think we are. Just as, again, River Master's kind of dedication was pointing at. And it's profound. We say it a lot. We say it a lot, and yet we don't. I myself rarely find myself in that place where I can actually see what that is, what's going on there. You know, kind of recognize, oh, that's pretty intense. That really must be affecting me. We rarely ever go there because it's kind of painful. It's really kind of saying we are separate from Buddha nature. And I believe it, you know, on that level. We rarely go there, so when we say it a lot, and it kind of sits around on the surface of things, we have to be, in a way, willing to go through the uncomfortableness of just being in that spot, being in that place, of letting go of our competence, letting go of our having people like us, whatever it is. This is my perspective. I hope that you will all be able to translate this into your own kind of view and experience, but and just sit there in that kind of feeling of inadequacy. Yeah.
Yes, David. And by sitting there, if it comes up, by sitting there, do you mean when other things in the world happen? You don't have to let that influence the way you respond, for example, to the immediate situation. I'm feeling inadequate. I'm feeling ashamed. So the way I respond to this situation is trying to compensate or fight or whatever. But just take a step back from it and then react or respond the way that's needed to.
A lot of times for me, if I'm able to sit still in that place of feeling inadequate or whatever it is, it will actually just change the situation in itself. It will change our response to the situation just by recognizing, here's this feeling and it's influencing me. And that kind of in its own way is a relief, like to be able to say, oh, I see that now. And so maybe there isn't so much energy about kind of doing, you know, kind of being super person or whatever. And so just by being open to the possibility that there's more to the picture than meets the eye, we are able to, in a sense, diffuse the situation and change it slightly. And then hopefully over time, we just increasingly are able to change our behaviors. A lot of our behaviors, again, are just designed to kind of cover up that layer. And when we see that's going on, then there's not really a need to do that stuff, and it, in a sense, diffuses. This is all kind of making sense.
Well, I guess if if you were in that place of feeling ashamed or whatever it is, if you responded with response A because you were trying to overcome and fight and battle and cover it up and run from it, okay, so you responded with response A. Okay, fine. That builds karma. That strengthens that habit. If you're sitting still within it or just recognizing, wow, I'm feeling really shameful right now, I'm feeling this at this time, you still could have response A, but perhaps you haven't added so much strength to that habit.
Yeah, and the kind of mental intensity of response A may change, and also you may then be able to see more clearly what the consequences of response A are. And you might begin to think, oh, response A isn't really all that great. Like if you're ashamed, if you are kind of prone to being angry as a response to whatever is going on, and you begin to recognize, oh, anger is actually a mechanism for coping with whatever is going on underneath it, you begin to see that, and then you begin to see what the real consequences of anger are more clearly. Partly because you begin to diffuse the relationship between whatever pain is underneath it and your angry response. You might still find yourself getting angry, but over time you begin to see more clearly what that actually means, and then you can keep yourself from doing that more effectively. Does that make sense? And part of the whole thing about meditation practice is that it gives us a means of, in a way, learning new kind of responses to our uncomfortable situations that we find ourselves in. By being still in meditation, we begin to see other aspects of, or other possibilities for responding to the situations. And this is, to bring ourselves back to what we're talking about, this is what it is to enlighten delusion. This kind of being still, being willing to look, being willing to apply the Dharma is our own enlightening our delusion. Okay. Most living beings are deluded within enlightenment. We don't really see the layers of ourselves. We don't really see that things have different implications in terms of how we feel deeply. We don't really see what's kind of going on in our minds and in our interactions. We just take things at face value in a way. And most of the time, for most of us, you know, it's fairly reasonable. We live within a certain level of morality, and we kind of follow the law and are happy and, you know, like to go to the movies and do whatever. You know, most of us live within a level of being unaware within enlightenment. We have the abundance, material abundance that we have in this country. We have the relative peace and safety. And this is a result of, you know, kind of positive action. You know, so in a sense, we're living within enlightenment, but without being able to see the deeper significance of things, or beginning to see the deeper significance of things. Some are enlightened within enlightenment. Some people clearly see Buddha nature and clearly see the significance of their actions and are training, are putting the teaching into practice. In whatever kind of state they may find themselves, they may not be Buddhist, but they may still be enlightened within enlightenment. They may still be working on these things, may still see the deeper significance of things. So I don't want to close off the possibility that this is, or kind of imply that this is strictly a Buddhist kind of understanding that people can see underneath what's going on. Others are deluded within delusion. And, you know, people, there are some people who are deeply suffering who are pretty well mired in their suffering, have difficult circumstances, believe in the difficult circumstances, believe that they are trapped in a way, and are deluded within delusion. There is no need, this is one of the most helpful lines I find in this chapter, there is no need to know that one is identical with Buddha when Buddha is truly Buddha. For a truly enlightened Buddha expresses his Buddhahood in his daily life. To observe objects and voices with complete awareness of body and mind is very different from seeing a reflection in a mirror or the moon reflected in water. Even if you see one side of something, the other will still be in shadow. There is no need to know that one is identical with Buddha when Buddha is truly Buddha. Later on, he says that... For a truly enlightened Buddha expresses Buddhahood in his daily life. And the way that we express Buddhahood in our daily life is just to do the practice. It's important to remember by going through the motions of practice, we're giving expression to something quite profound and quite deep. And, you know, there's a kind of thing which is interesting. It's, you know, the science of the mind is growing these days, you know. They've done studies where people who have, cultures that have some sort of ceremonial quality to their meal times have much less incidence of eating disorders than cultures that don't do any kind of ceremonial around eating. So just the very thing of like setting the table, going in to eat, sitting down all together, turning off the TV is in a sense a kind of ceremonial quality to eating. And this has some kind of a perceivable benefit for beings. I guess the thing that it makes me think is that by incorporating religious practice into your daily life responds to a basic need of human beings. It responds to some basic comforting quality in sort of need for comfort in human beings. You know, just the fact, say, again, back to the mealtime, just the fact of saying the five thoughts before you eat can help something. Just the fact of, we were talking the other day, saying verses before brushing your teeth or, you know, kind of getting up and doing meditation in a formal way. This kind of activity responds to and fills a need that human beings seem to have. And so, again, I just sort of encourage this. And when you're doing that, Dogen says, when you're doing that, we're giving expression to enlightenment. We're giving expression to Buddhahood right there in that activity. And so we don't really actually need to know, in a sense, that we're giving expression to enlightenment. We can just do that. We can just live that life. Can just train ourselves. And to me, this is, again, quite comforting, because how it helps to facilitate the letting go of our opinions about what enlightenment is. Because, as Dogen says, we actually can't know in an intellectual way what enlightenment is. Does this make sense? There seems to be one of the ongoing kind of struggles or questions that people have is how to kind of know that I'm enlightened. Am I enlightened yet? And well, you know, you never actually know. Observant Master Chi used to say, you can never know when you're enlightened. You can only, you never know when you're meditating. You can only know when you're not meditating. Same is true with kind of enlightenment. Well, actually, you can't even know when you're not enlightened. Although, you know when you feel lousy, so you can go on. To observe objects and voices with complete awareness of body and mind is very different from seeing a reflection in a mirror or the moon reflected in water. Again, a very kind of profound idea here, and refers right directly to the practice of meditation. And actually to what we were talking about before, about feeling, having feelings, being ashamed of ourselves, having a particular opinion about ourselves. The more we sit still with our own minds, the more clearly we see what's going on, the more we're able to just simply allow it to come and go. And there is a great tranquility that arises with this, this process. And again, even if you see one side of something, the other will still be in shadow. This goes back to where we started. When we wish to teach and enlighten all things by ourselves, we are deluded. When all things teach and enlighten us, we are enlightened. Part of that is knowing, part of that mind which is willing to be enlightened by all conditions is knowing that we don't see the whole picture. No matter who we are or how profound of an experience we have, we still do not see the whole picture. This is completely acceptable. This is completely fine. It's just the nature of being human being. So I'm going to stop talking about Dogen there and then just say one more thing, and then we can sort of open up for questions that we have. Another important point about reading this, again, I made this before and I'll make this point again, which is that our as we read through it, as we read through anything Dogen wrote or the scriptures, our understanding of it will change and shift. And so I am talking about it at the level at which I hopefully understand it and not just throwing out ideas that I've accumulated. And my understanding of it is not necessarily the best or the be-all or end-all. It's not the end of the thing. As you read it, you might see it in a different light, and you might see it in a different with a different kind of perspective. And it might be completely different than my perspective. So don't discount that. This is just my perspective for right now. And hopefully, as you kind of go through it, it will help to illuminate the possibilities, but not necessarily give you the correct interpretation. So, any thoughts or questions about it? Okay.